So thank you all for coming early on a Sunday morning. I know it's very difficult to get up, so thank you so much for coming. Today we're going to be learning about Eliyahu Hanavi. And specifically, we're going to be learning about Eliyahu Hanavi in the Agadah. So I thought before we started learning, going through the sources, I would just give kind of a quick introduction to what Agadah really is and kind of how it manifests in Jewish texts, okay? So I'm not sure how familiar people are with Agadah, but mainly the texts that we're talking about span from the times of the Tanaim, the Tanaitic period. So that's probably prior to about 200 CE, okay? And during the Tanaitic period, this is when the kind of compilation of the Mishnah was happening. So that's the time period we're talking about. And this period spans, the Agadic period is also kind of in conjunction, happening at the same time as this Tanaitic period, the compilation of the Mishnah. And it can go, these Agadot were talked about and written about all the way through to about the 600 CE, and even possibly beyond, well into possibly the 13th century. So this is a huge, huge span of time that we're talking about here in terms of compilation of Agadot. And what is Agada exactly? Agada, as Professor Avigdor Shinan, who is a professor of Bible in Hebrew University, Professor Avigdor Shinan talks about how an Agadic text is any text that does not talk specifically about halacha. So really, an Agadic text is any non-halachic text. So that includes any stories that you hear about in the Gemara that talk about rabbis. I think some people are familiar with some of these stories. Any stories you hear about kinds of interpretation of the Tanakh, and any kind of general discussions maybe about astrology that you'd hear about in the Gemara or in other texts, those are all considered Agadic texts. Okay? And then within this kind of category of Agadah, all these non-halachic discussions, within this category of Agadah, we have what we are known as the Midrashim, right? And a Midrashic text is kind of a subcategory of Agadah, because a Midrashic text is talking specifically about texts that are commenting on a specific part of the Bible, of the Tanakh. Okay, so a Midrashic text, what that means is that it will be a text that is, again, non-halachic, specifically a Midrash Agadah, so it's a non-halachic text, but it's talking about, it's commenting on a specific part of the Bible. And so today we'll be learning a little bit of general Agadah, so general kind of stories about rabbis that are not specifically pertaining to a Tanakh or a biblical text itself. And we'll also be learning Midrash, which is, again, stories that are relating specifically and commenting specifically on biblical text. Okay, so that's kind of a quick intro. Obviously, there's much more to say, but that's kind of a quick intro to what Agadah is all about. Okay, and if anyone has questions during the kind of Chavruta session, I'll be happy to try to answer. Okay, and today we're going to be talking about Agadah, specifically relating to Eliyahu Hanavi. And Eliyahu Hanavi is a very, very confusing character in my mind. I'm just going to lower this a little annoying. Eliyahu Hanavi is a very confusing character in my mind. On one hand, we know that he was one of the greatest Nevi'im. Hashem really, really listened to him. But at the same time, Eliyahu Hanavi has a very difficult relationship with God, as you'll see as we go through some of the texts. A very difficult to understand relationship, a very complicated relationship. And he's also really the only Navi who, even though he was a great Navi, he was also rejected by God. And he was rejected by God and then replaced by another Navi, Elisha HaNavi. And he's really the only Navi in our Tanakh who we know who really God kind of had to replace midstream, in the middle of his career. Eliyahu Hanavi is also omnipresent, right? Even after all of the stories that we learn about him in the Tanakh, he keeps reappearing in many, many Agadic texts. And we know that he keeps repeating himself in our Jewish tradition itself. We hear about him probably every Shabbos. A lot of people sing after Havdalah. They sing about Eliyahu Hanavi. We know he visits us at the Seder. We know he visits us when we do a Brit Milah. Eliyahu Hanavi is present in our everyday lives all the time, really outside of the biblical text. Okay, and so today we're going to start off by learning the first stories of Eliyahu Hanavi, the beginning story of Eliyahu Hanavi, how he kind of rose to power, and how the Tanakh presents the introduction, the first stages in Eliyahu's career as a Navi. So we're going to start off by reading that source number one, and you guys can all do it in Chavruta together. And I'll just give a quick intro to source number one before you start, okay, and I'll explain to you what to do. So source number one, we're starting off during the time period of Eliyahu Hanavi, is simultaneous with the time period of Ahav. Ahav was a king of Israel. He was known as one of the worst kings of Israel, and Eliyahu has a very kind of touch-and-go relationship with Ahav. And the two of them, the way that their personalities play out throughout the Tanakh, throughout the ends of Malachim Aleph, is very interesting to see. So I started off with a little introduction of how the Tanakh introduces Ahav to us. And then, after our introduction of Ahav, we'll read about how the Tanakh then presents Eliyahu Hanavi to us. And as you read through the sources, that first source over there in the Tanakh, I just want you to I have some leading questions for you. Take a look at them and discuss them amongst yourselves. But in general, I want you to think about how the Tanakh presents Ahav and how the Tanakh presents Eliyahu Hanavi, and specifically what you think about Eliyahu Hanavi's relationship with God in some of the stories that you'll read. Okay? After that first source, I want you then to go on and read the Agadic source that I've brought, the Midrashic source that I've brought from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. It's in English for you, so you don't have to worry about the Aramaic. You can read it in English as well. If you want to take a shot at it in Aramaic, that's awesome too. Then I just want you to read the Agadah, or the Midrash, from Sanhedrin, and see how it relates back, and see how the Midrash then reads in to the original text in the Tanakh. Okay, so just those two sources we'll do right now, and I'll be walking around and answering any questions that you have. And if you can pair up, you can do it by yourselves. You can pair up and discuss. I'd love for some discussion to happen. And we'll talk again in a little bit. Great. So why don't we start our discussion about the sources that we just read. Excuse me. Okay. So what does everybody, I'd like to hear everybody, some people's or any, first impressions of the pshat of the Tanakh, just first impressions of reading the stories of Eliyahu without the Midrash. So try to kind of put the Midrash, put the Agadah, the text from Sanhedrin, out of your mind. What were some first impressions of the general text? First, let's talk about Ahav. How does the Tanakh present Ahav? What are the three specific things that the Tanakh talks about that happened or that Ahav did during his time? Anyone want to tell me? Pardon? One thing that Ahav did. Let's start with one thing that Ahav did during his time. Yeah. Pardon? Idol worship. Yes. Okay. Ahav is famous for his idol worship. He brought idol worship to Bnei Israel. Great. Anything else? What else did Ahav do during his time? Yeah. He married Izebel. Excellent. So maybe the first thing is he married Izebel. The second thing is that he did idol worship. Sorry, when you raise your hand, can you just tell me your name?
Shayna.
Hi. Thank you. Okay. So he marries Izebel, and the way that the Tanakh presents it, it's possible that he marries Izebel. Where is it? Vayikachisha et Izebel. And then the next pasuk, it says, Vayakem Izbeach, right? So it's possible that by marrying Izebel, that kind of was a driving force. She then became a driving force behind the subsequent idol worship, possibly. And what's the third thing that happened during Ahav's time? Yeah, Ellen. Right, someone from Chiel Beit El, Chiel Beit Ha'eli, he decides to rebuild Yericho. And can you just remind everybody why that's a bad thing?
So at the time that Yeshua conquered the land, the first city they conquered was Yericho, and God miraculously made the city fall, and then Yeshua came and conquered Yericho, and told people they can't take anything from the city, they're not allowed to take the spoils, the stuff goes to Hashem, and that they're not allowed to ever build Yericho again. And then he put a curse on the city that somebody who tries to build it, with the first door, the first son will die, and
perfect. Okay, excellent. Thank you, Ellen. So, Okay, these are the three things that happen during Ahav's time. He marries Izebel. He goes to Avodah Zarah, idol worship. And in his time, Biyamav, Chiyal Beit Ha'eli rebuilds Jericho, which is definitely a negative thing. And our Gemara that we then read in Sanhedrin, actually the discussion of our Gemara comes about because the Gemara is about Ir Hanidachat. Does everyone know what an Ir Hanidachat is? Could someone just explain what it is? Anyone know? Yeah, go ahead.
It's a city that's so evil that essentially you have to cut off all contact with it. And it becomes isolated.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. Ir Hanidachat. And then ultimately the idea is that the city then should be destroyed, right? That's the idea of Ir Hanidachat. And the discussion in the Gemara is about Ir Hanidachat. And then you can kind of think of the obvious connections between this idea of Ir Hanidachat, this isolated city, and Yericha, right? Again, which was destroyed and should not be rebuilt. And so the Gemara starts to talk about the rebuilding of Yericho, and that's how it kind of gets into our text of Chiyal Beit Ha'eli. And the discussion in the Gemara, I think just to let you know, the discussion in the Gemara is about, are we not allowed to rebuild Yericho, specifically the place Yericho, rebuild Yericho in its place? Or is there also an Isser, are we also not allowed to rebuild a city and name it Yericho? Meaning, we can rebuild a city, let's say we rebuilt a city north of Thornhill somewhere, you know, and we named it Yericho, even though it's really far away from the original Yericho, is that also not permitted? And the Gemara concludes that the way that Chiyal Beit Ha'eli rebuilt Yericho was of the second type, meaning he didn't rebuild Yericho in the place Yericho, but he rebuilt some other city in some other location, and called it, just happened to name it, Yericho. And that's what the Gemara concludes. So after hearing that, how might that put a different spin on the sin of Chiyal Beit Ha'eli? Knowing that he didn't rebuild the original Yericho, but he rebuilt Yericho in some other place and called it Yericho. How might that put a different spin on the sin of Chiyal Beit Ha'eli? Any suggestions? Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Okay, excellent. So you're saying two things. It's possible that Chiyal Beit Ha'eli was so familiar with the curse of Yehoshua, and he was so familiar with it, and he knew all different sides and all the different facets and all the different isurim that were associated with the curse, that he was doing it despite Yehoshua, right? Kind of to incite either the prophet of the time or whatever, right? Or that he was just unaware and he decided, well, you know, the curse was about Yericho itself. I'll build it somewhere else, call it Yericho, and that should be fine. Okay, so meaning that from the previous text of the Gemara that I didn't give you, so I'm telling you now, it's a little bit unclear how severe Chiel's sin actually was. Okay? Now let's just go on. We'll talk about that later again as we talk about interpreting the Agadah itself. So now let's just talk a little bit about the story of Eliyahu. Thoughts about Eliyahu. What did you see as the connection? Why were the Parshiyot Nismichu? Lama Nismichu Parshiyot? What's the connection between the story of Ahav and then the story of Eliyahu? Obviously, the Agadah fills that in for us, but what did you think the connection was? Any ideas? Ellen, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, excellent. So what you're saying, Ellen, is that you see a very clear, the way that the Midrash interprets this, you think that's definitely the pshat of the psukim. Okay, beautiful. Any other suggestions? Okay, I think everyone maybe was a little bit tainted by the Midrash. It's possible. Okay. Any ideas about Hashem's relationship with Eliyahu throughout the stories? First, he sends him to Nachal Crete, and then he sends him to this Isha Almana. Any ideas about God's relationship with Eliyahu? How do you think God was relating to Eliyahu throughout the stories? Yeah.
Well, first of all, bother that Eliyahu goes to Achav on his own without God telling him. Tell them that there won't be any rain.
Okay. Okay, excellent. So what you're saying is you're pointing out that the way Eliyahu is introduced is very different from any other Navi that we see. Every other Navi before he says his nevuah, we see he has maybe a nevuah ha-hakdasha, meaning an introduction that kind of initiates him into being the Navi. We see that with Moshe. We see that with the later Nevi'im, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, for sure. And we also see that with most Nevi'im, there's always a directive from God. God says to the Navi, this is what you should do. And then the Navi, in his own way, maybe, but still from a directive from God, goes and tells the people exactly what to do. What you're bothered by is that he says, Vayomer Eliyahu Tishbi, Chai Hashem, it's his own directive. There's no, it doesn't seem like Hashem told him anything. Yes?
The other thing that struck us was that he says, no rain will fall except by my word.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievably.
Yes, yes. Ti'im lefi dvari, right? It's totally his own initiative, right? It's totally by himself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Beautiful. Okay. Anyone see a positive relationship between God and Eliyahu in the narrative? Anything positive that you saw? Any ideas? Yeah. Okay. A, God looks out for him. He's sending him to these places because he wants him to be fed. He wants him to be taken care of. Anything else that we see that's positive, a positive relationship? Yeah. Okay, that God is even speaking to him in the first place. Anything else? Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, so you're seeing it as maybe a positive thing, like lichrot brit, that they have this kind of relationship with each other, this intimate relationship, maybe. Okay, excellent. Anything else? What about the fact that Hashem is performing miracles for Eliyahu as soon as Eliyahu says, I need this miracle, right? That's unbelievable. Eliyahu, even though we're bothered by the fact that Eliyahu says that there shouldn't be talu matar ki'im lefi dvari, and even though maybe we were bothered, I'm not sure how people felt, about the fact that Eliyahu told the woman, well, don't worry, you're going to have enough food as long as I'm here with you. And even though we may be bothered, I don't know why you would be bothered, by Eliyahu breathing life into the boy, meaning resurrecting the son, those things all still happen because, obviously, it's obvious from the text that God was in some way on Eliyahu's side, right? God, even though people were saying that a little bit, that there's this negative relationship going on, it's obvious that the Tanakh is trying to tell us that there is a positive relationship going on, meaning God is in many ways endorsing what Eliyahu is doing. If God wasn't endorsing him, he wouldn't have performed all these miracles for him. Okay, so we're getting a little bit into the complexities of the relationship between God and Eliyahu. Okay, now let's turn to what the Agadah was saying. So everyone could just turn to the Agadah. Okay, and I think in general, it's possible people were tainted by the Agadah, so I apologize for that. But I think in general, the Agadah is generally agreeing with what most people were saying, which is that there is kind of this negative tone, this possibly Hashem is not so happy with Eliyahu. Let's start with the first part of the Agadah, okay? So that's just that first paragraph in the English. The first part of the Agadah, where Achav and Eliyahu are both going to visit Chiel Beit HaEli when he's essentially sitting Shiva for all of his kids who have passed away as he was building Yericha. Okay, and let's read together, what does Achav say? Okay, Achav sat and said, perhaps, does everyone see that? Okay, perhaps the reason for these terrible losses is that when Joshua laid a curse upon the person who had built Yericha, this is how he laid the curse. Neither Yericha by another name, nor another city by the name of Yericha. And that's what we were talking about in the Gemara, how it could be either the place or the name. Either one is wrong, right? What's Achav saying? Impressions about what Achav's saying. Okay, excellent. So you're saying that Achav, even though we kind of presented him initially in the text as a very negative figure, he's still, A, coming to visit his friend who's basically mourning the loss of his children, and he's also recognizing that there's this greater kind of divine presence in the world that directs the different things that happen in the world. What else? Yeah? Excellent. Okay, so we're going with what the Gemara was saying, which is that possibly Chiel Beit Ha'eli built the city in a different place and called it Yericha. And it's possible that what Achav is saying is not necessarily to incite and not necessarily because he's maliciously saying, well, look at what happens to Chiel because of what Yahushua said, and he's trying to incite because Moshe's prophecy hadn't come true. But rather, he's really wondering, right? Is this really... Is what happened to my friend Chiel really because of what Yehoshua said, right? And it's possible that Achav really, the Agada might be painting Achav not in a totally negative light, but maybe the Gemara or the Agada is painting Achav in maybe a light that's more positive, more, he's kind of not in the know. He doesn't really know what's going on, and he's asking a genuine question, possibly, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think he's setting up a straw man, mm-hmm. so that he can administer the knockout punch and say, what are you accepting this absurd idea mm-hmm. that God is enforcing curses in this world?
Mm-hmm.
The Moshe's curses, they didn't even work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. So you're saying, no, definitely the Agada is setting up Achav as a negative person. Okay, it's possible, but I think that based on what we know, that it was kind of unclear from the curse, and it was kind of unclear where Chiel Beit Ha'eli built the city, and the curse maybe wasn't as clear as day as maybe we saw it initially, according to the Gemara. It is possible to show that the Agada is kind of painting Achav as not as much of a negative character as we initially may have thought. Maybe he really is kind of wondering, and he's not really sure. Okay? But how does Eliyahu react to what Achav says? Where Achav maybe, he says perhaps, maybe Achav isn't sure. How does Eliyahu react to what Achav says in the Agadah? What's Eliyahu's immediate reaction? Yeah, Ellen. Yeah. Absolutely, this is what happened, right? And we know that Hashem is, we always say that Hashem is erech apayim, he's slow to anger. And Eliyahu, we see here in the Agadah paints Eliyahu as exactly the opposite. Eliyahu sees this as a direct cause, and that is Eliyahu's personality. He sees everything as black and white, okay? Eliyahu, according to the Agadah, where Achav is not sure, he isn't really certain about where this punishment is coming from, Eliyahu right away jumps up, like Ellen said, and he says, no, this is impossible. The only explanation is that you were wrong, and this is a direct punishment for what you did. And that's a very, very strong thing to say, a very strong argument to make, okay? And so, and then we can understand from the Agadah fills in all these holes for us. It bridges the gap between Perek Ted Zayin, chapter 16, and Perek Yud Zayin, where Achav is sinning with Chiel, and then where Eliyahu says there should not be any rain, and obviously the Agadah bridges that gap between those two. And then the Agadah continues, and what does the Agadah do? It talks about these different keys. Can anyone explain to me what those keys are for? Anyone remember in the Agadah? Yeah.
Childbirth,
resurrection, and rain. Okay, and what's going on with the keys with Hashem and Eliyahu?
The question is, does God delegate?
Okay.
And the answer is, sometimes but not always.
Mm-hmm.
Never with more than one key at a time.
Okay, excellent. So never with more than one key at a time. And why never with more than one key at a time?
Because who's in charge here?
Okay. Okay, good. So, yeah? Yes, exactly. These are the keys. He does. Well, the idea is that God keeps the keys for himself. Right. Okay, so.
And in this case, he actually gave out a key.
Yeah. Okay, it's a great question. We see it in one more place in Eliyahu's replacement, Elisha. Okay, Elisha also is able to kind of gain the keys, and we'll talk about that story in a few minutes. Elisha also is able to ask Hashem and in the same way for the same keys in order to resurrect the child. But Eliyahu is the only one we see who asks for two of those keys, the rain and the resurrection of the child, okay, according to the Agadah. And what the Agadah does for us is it very nicely splits up the story basically into three or four different sections. If everyone can turn over their page to source number 4, Okay? The Haggadah highlights a few different psukim for us. And instead of making this kind of a complicated, convoluted story of Eliyahu going from place to place, the Haggadah just highlights a few of those psukim for us to really highlight for us how the Haggadah feels about Eliyahu in these stories, okay? And we'll just read those psukim together. So I just have the first pasuk the Haggadah talks about is why Eliyahu got angry. After Eliyahu got angry at Ahav, he then says, there's not going to be any rain. That's that first pasuk. Then what does God do in response to what Eliyahu says? The first thing God does, okay, in part A, does everybody see that? Vayhidvar Hashem elav lemor. Immediately after Eliyahu says there shouldn't be rain, God says, Lech mizeu panita lecha kedma, and he starts habinachal krit, asher al pnei hayarden. Okay, so as a response to what Eliyahu did, that there shouldn't be rain, God sends him to Nachal Krit. Why do you think God sends him to Nachal Krit? What's the purpose? What's the idea behind God sending him to Nachal Krit? Yeah. Okay, good. So one opinion is that Hashem is trying to protect Eliyahu. He's sending him away so that God doesn't reach him. Yeah. Oh, excellent. Okay, he's sending him to Nachal Krit, but he's not making him very comfortable. How is he not making him comfortable by sending him to Nachal Krit? Okay. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's making him suffer a bit, yeah? Okay, excellent. So it's possible that even though, great, I think that's a great idea, that maybe Hashem is trying to make Eliyahu suffer like the people. But there's a few problems with that. Yeah, you want to say something too?
He's making Eliyahu feel dependent on Hashem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So in terms of our power struggle discussion, God is gaining the power over Eliyahu by kind of putting him in this lower position to God. Beautiful. Okay, but in terms of Nachal Krit, I'm not so sure that Hashem is sending him to an uncomfortable place, and there's a few things that kind of indicate that to me. Everyone can turn back to source number one. Okay, what does it say in Pasuk Vav? Does everybody see source number one? So we're in Perek Yud Zayin, so the second Perek. It says in Pasuk Vav, V'ha'orvim mivi'im lo lechem u'basar ba'boker v'lechem u'basar ba'erev u'min ha'nachal yishteh, right? Not only is he getting food, he's getting a lot of food. He's getting meat every single day, a few times a day. That's pretty significant. Yes, but... He wasn't going to be comfortable throughout the whole thing. I think the idea, though, of Nachal Krit is a little bit different from the direction you're taking it, if I may, okay? So we were talking about before how Krit could be Koret Brit, but many Parshanim also say that Krit is like Karet, exactly, cutting him off from the people, removing Eliyahu from the people. And that, in a way, is a punishment, maybe, to isolate Eliyahu from the people, and yet to still give him, to still sustain him twice a day. Why is it important to still sustain him twice a day? He's removed from the people. He knows what's going on in the rest of Eretz Yisrael, that there's a drought and then obviously a famine that follows from the drought. But Eliyahu is being fed like a king every single day. Why is that important? What's the contrast? What's Hashem trying to tell Eliyahu by bringing him, cutting him off, bringing him to Nachal Krit, and giving him a lot of food? What might be the idea behind that? Any ideas? Okay. I think what might be happening is that Hashem's first attempt, what the Haggadah is telling us by bringing this first pasuk, is that this is Hashem's first attempt at teaching Eliyahu a lesson, like you were saying, but I think the opposite. He's not saying, I'm going to cut you off and treat you badly and put you in a bad place, but rather, look what you did to the people. I'm going to cut you off and make you so comfortable that it's almost disgusting. It's almost gluttonous. You're going to have so much food. And what does the Haggadah say? The Haggadah specifically says, Where is the food coming from? Does anyone remember? Where is the food coming from, according to the Agadah? From Ahab's kitchens, from the person who you put the curse on, the person who you are specifically making suffer during this time. I'm going to take the food from him and give it to you so that you understand that you understand so that you're thinking to yourself, I'm sitting here all high and pretty, and I'm sitting here and I'm eating so much food from the person who I cursed. And maybe what Hashem is trying to tell Eliyahu is, hopefully this will kind of make you rethink what you've done to the people. Yeah, you were going to say. Ah, excellent, beautiful, right. A lot of Parshanim talk about how the Arvim, the ravens, are very negative birds. Right, exactly. They're not usually ones to bring you food. And again, the negative symbol is bringing him food. Right, so many Parshanim see this again, that God was angry with Ahav, and angry with Eliyahu, and that's why he was sending the Orvim, who are usually malicious birds as opposed to nicer birds. Exactly, beautiful. Okay, and I think that that's what the Agadah is really pointing out to us, that this first stage is really a first shot, a first attempt at God trying to tell Eliyahu, you really went wrong. This was really not a good idea. I'm not really happy with what you did with this whole rain thing. Why doesn't that work for Eliyahu? Why doesn't Eliyahu change after the Orvin situation, after the Nachal Crit story? Why do you think that Hashem then has to come to Eliyahu and say to him, now you have to go to this woman's house? What's the idea behind that? Based on what we know about Eliyahu, why is cutting Eliyahu off not going to teach Eliyahu a lesson? Yes? Exactly, right? The whole reason Eliyahu is always separate from Am Yisrael. Eliyahu is never one to empathize with Am Yisrael. Beautiful. Eliyahu, in this story, where Ahav is kind of wondering, why did my friend get punished? What happened? This is so terrible. Eliyahu is always the one who's quick to judge and never one to put himself in someone else's shoes. So the Orvim, the Nachal Crit, that's not going to help Eliyahu come around. That's feeding into his personality, exactly. And so, what's Hashem's second attempt? What does the Agadah point out to us next? In B, does everybody see? Kum lach tzarfata asher letzidon v'yashavta sham hinei tziviti sham isha almana l'kalkelcha. Okay? Now, I want you to go to Tzarfat, and what's going to happen in Tzarfat? I'm going to send you to this woman, and she's going to keep you, she's going to sustain you. What's interesting about sending Eliyahu to the Isha Almana specifically? Why is God sending her to an Isha Almana, yeah?
Because the Almana is one of the examples of someone who is desperate and powerless and unable to sustain anyone.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, right? Hashem is not sending Eliyahu into a luxurious situation this time. Hashem is specifically sending him into the nation, into somebody who is definitely poverty-stricken, into someone's house who is definitely suffering very, very greatly from this terrible drought that Eliyahu has inflicted. What's God's hope by sending Eliyahu to the Isha Almana? What's going to happen as a result of sending Eliyahu to the Isha Almana, do you think? Pardon? He'll maybe gain compassion, right? Does Eliyahu gain compassion in the house of the Isha Almana? How do you know? Excellent, right? He says, every day, you're going to have enough food as long as you always feed me first. It's always about me. And there's an interesting kriyuktiv. Did everybody catch that? It's in the first source, Paragiyot Zayin, Pasuk Tet Vav. Vatelech vataaseh kidvar Eliyahu. So she goes, she listens to Eliyahu. Vatochal hu vehi, hi vahu. Does everyone see that? There's a kriyuktiv. Hu vahi hi vahu ubeta yamim, right? So what the Parshanim say about this is that Eliyahu was always the one who had to be the one to eat first. But we want to be melamed zchut on the woman. We want to make sure that she gets a little bit of praise, that she listened to Eliyahu every single day, and every day she kind of put her life in her own hands by giving Eliyahu the food first and then herself eating. who va he va who. She should really be mentioned. She should really be kind of Zachor Latov. But the Tanakh points out to us that he's the one who eats every day, meaning the miracle that he asked God for was only for him. And it just happened to be that she needed to be there because God told him, you have to be there. She's going to sustain you. Only because she's there are you going to continue leaving. So he's kind of forced to be dependent on her. Yeah. Ah, excellent. And that's a really great question. I really am not sure what that significance might be. I'm not sure. That's a great question, though. It's a really interesting parallel. Not sure. Any ideas of why that might be? Okay. And so what does God then have to do? The Agadah points out to us. Then God is then forced to do what? In C, does everybody see that? Source 4C. What does God then have to do? Exactly. So then we have the last step three. Step one was send him away. That didn't work. Step two, send him to this almanah. That didn't work. Step three is essentially kill the widow's son. And let's see what happens then. Okay. And what happens when God kills the widow's son? What's the result of that?
Eliyahu saves him.
And how does Eliyahu save him? Do you think that that teaches Eliyahu a lesson? Okay, it shows him how much power he has. And we're going back to the Agadah, how it's talking about how Eliyahu always asks God for a miracle when he needs a miracle. He did the same thing with the Tzapachat HaShemen, and the Agadah points out he then asks for the keys from God again, right, to save the child, which we know is something that's very rarely done. So you're saying that he's still kind of trying to stay in this position of power. Okay, yeah? And?
The point is, it's not her problem, it's my problem.
Okay.
I will be inconvenienced if her son dies.
Okay, so you're seeing this also as possibly negative. What's one hint that maybe Eliyahu may have learned something? Does everybody see the very, very last pasuk, pasuk kaf dalet of Perek Yud Zayin? What's one hint that there may have been a little bit of a change in Eliyahu after he saves the son? Okay, what does the Isha say? Yeah. Excellent, okay. Finally, the woman. We don't have any mention of the woman knowing that Eliyahu was a Ish Elokim, was an Ish Navi, until after, even when Eliyahu was performing all these miracles for her, even when Eliyahu was feeding her every single day, we have no idea if the woman knows that Eliyahu is actually an Ish Elokim. Until after he saves her son, then she says, "Atayah dati ki yesh Elokim atah dvar v'arba picha emet." Yes.
Well, actually, she does say in verse 18, she calls him an Ish Elokim.
Ah, okay.
Really bitter.
Bitter. Yes, exactly. Do you think you're a man of God if my son is dead? It's clearly bitter. Tzapachat Hashemen. Yes, for sure. But think about the time period and think about how many Nevi'ei Sheker there were. Think about how many people were saying, I'm a prophet of God. Right. Right. Exactly. Yes, for sure. I think only after she sees somehow, maybe there was a slight change in Eliyahu. Maybe there was a little bit of a change in Eliyahu where Eliyahu, for an instant, maybe, had some compassion, real compassion, for what the almanah was going through in losing her son. Only after that does she come out and say, now I know you're a man of God. Maybe. According to the Midrash, I think the Midrash would really agree with what Sabrina was saying. I think that, look at what the Midrash does, right? Pardon? Okay, very possibly. And I think the Midrash would agree with you. Meaning the Midrash puts it as point C, right? I put it as Moitzi, but the Midrash brings it in as that pasuk. That was Eliyahu's third test. And then if you turn the page to number D, the Midrash brings in that final pasuk, saying that even after Hashem tried three times to teach Eliyahu a lesson, after that, what happened? Hashem still has to come to Eliyahu and say, Eliyahu, this is it. You have to go to Ahav and tell Ahav that there's going to be rain. I've had enough. I tried so many times. I even killed a child. And you still kind of tried to force me to perform a miracle for you. Enough is enough. I'm going to force you to give the people back the rain because you are acting in an incorrect way. So I think that the Agadah would agree with what you're saying, Sabrina. Yeah. How would God have wanted Eliyahu to react? Well, it's possible. I mean, it is 100% possible that if Eliyahu hadn't had any compassion after staying with her for that long, Eliyahu would have said, well, I guess this is it. Like, the kid is dead, and I guess this is me being kicked out of the house, right? Meaning Eliyahu still tries everything to bring the son back to life. Yeah.
You're saying in a negative way that Eliyahu always asks for a miracle.
Mm-hmm. I do think that it's possible. I do think that the Agadah agrees that maybe the way Eliyahu, let me go back to the steps, okay? I think that it's possible. I think that in the end, the story with the son is showing a slightly positive side of Eliyahu's personality. I do think that for sure. And I think that Eliyahu asking on behalf of the woman for Hashem to save her son is a positive thing. On the other hand, the way that the Agadah is reading it, I think the Agadah is seeing it as, well, God told you, Eliyahu, that you have to be at this woman's house, and only by being at this woman's house are you going to live and are you going to be sustained. And the woman is essentially saying, you killed my son, get out of here. So if Eliyahu left, that's basically his death sentence. So I think it's possible the Agadah still sees it as a negative asking for a miracle, meaning still Eliyahu's trying to do it in order to sustain himself, just for himself. Even though it's possible from the pshat that there is something positive about it, the Agadah seems to be reading it as a negative thing because it follows it with the pasuk of God forcing Eliyahu to go tell Ahab that there has to be rain. Okay? Does that answer that? Okay, great. So I think that kind of going that the Agadah really, really takes a very harsh, negative perspective of Eliyahu, and even the very end of the Agadah, I'm not sure if everybody read the end of the Agadah with Rabbi Yossi, how Rabbi Yossi calls Eliyahu a kapdan, right? He's sensitive, he's hot-tempered, what are you thinking? It's a really cute story, actually, if you haven't gotten a chance to read it. It's very cute. Rabbi Yossi comes and tells Eliyahu, you're so hot-tempered, how are you treating Ahav? What were you thinking? And Eliyahu used to visit Rabbi Yossi's Beit Midrash every day, and Eliyahu then just disappears. And then finally he comes back and Rabbi Yossi says, well, why are you so angry? What's going on? And Eliyahu says, well, you called me a kapdan, so I got angry at you. And Rabbi Yossi says, well, you got angry just for me calling you a kapdan. How can I not call you a kapdan, right? That's how the story ends. Meaning, yes, this is in relation to this story, right? It's following the story immediately. It follows in the Gemara. Excellent. What do you think about that parable? What do you think about that parable? What did that mean? That when Eliyahu gave back the keys to God, that's parallel to a man locking himself out of his house. What do you think the Agadah is trying to say by that? Any ideas about that? Yeah.
Since God only gives one key away at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Give up the privilege, give up the key to the rain. And now the problem was, what does he do with the national problem?
Uh-huh.
And so that's why God has to then come and tell him, okay, go and deal with the rain. It's still in your court, even though you, as it were, abandoned it in order to save the woman's child.
Okay, even though you abandoned it to save the woman's child. Great. What you don't like that explanation? Pardon? You don't get the explanation. Okay, so what? I'm not 100% sure either exactly.
Well, Eliyahu knows that he still has to address the national problem, that the famine is continuing, but he has lost the key. He can't get back in to deal with it because he gave up the key to the rain in order to revive the child. So that's why I think he's like a man who lost the key, but the house is still there. He still has to get in.
He still has to get back in order to give them back their rain. Okay, I think going along this a little similarly to the same lines that you're saying a little bit, I think that the idea is that Eliyahu basically painted himself into a corner, right? That he kind of gained control of the rain. He said that there should not be any more rain, and he gained the control of the rain. And then, according to the Haggadah, he gave it up by asking for that second key. But even not according to the Haggadah, he paints himself into a corner because Hashem has to force him to come to terms with what he did. Hashem has to force him to give back the rain. The idea is that he locked himself, I think, that he locked himself outside his house. What, were you going to say something about it? No? Sorry. The idea is that he locked himself outside his house, meaning he locked himself outside of his own ideal. His ideal was that until Bnei Israel came around and until Bnei Israel realized why there was no rain, Eliyahu was going to hold out and he was not going to give them any rain. And what the Gemara is saying is that Hashem is eventually going to force Eliyahu to give back the rain because he disagrees with what Eliyahu did in the first place. And so Eliyahu kind of boxes himself into a corner. He did something, but now he can't get back in. He can't really get back to what his ideals really were. Okay, and Hashem kind of paints him into a corner. Hashem forces him to go against that ideal. I think that might be what the Haggadah is trying to get at. Okay, any suggestions, any other comments on that? It's kind of an interesting parable, a little bit difficult to understand. Did you want to say something about it? Yeah. Sorry, you wanted to say? Yeah.
Or because Eliyahu was audacious towards God with his demands, that's why the gate with God was closed, and that's why he lost the key.
That meaning his relationship with God was locked?
Because he demanded it in such an audacious way, and used it inappropriately,
Okay. Okay. So going along kind of the same lines. Okay. Excellent. Okay. Beautiful. So what I'd like everyone to do, does anyone have the time? 11. Okay. So we have a little bit of time left. What I'd like everyone to do, just quickly, the Haggadah clearly takes kind of a negative view of Eliyahu. As many of the negative points as we saw by ourselves by reading just the pshat, the Haggadah really drives them home by only really talking about the psukim where Hashem forces Eliyahu into these situations where Hashem clearly seems to be angry at Eliyahu. The Haggadah takes this perspective of Eliyahu that he's very hot-tempered, that he gets very angry too quickly, and he's very, very zealous for God in maybe a negative way. And the next source that we have... is the story of Elisha. I brought you the story of Elisha just to kind of drive the point home of why God felt it was so necessary to have a different prophet in place of Eliyahu. If you have time, you can read it quickly. Otherwise, I'd like to read about some of the Haggadot that are talked about, that talk about Eliyahu after Eliyahu's passing or after Eliyahu's disappearance. As I think we all know, Eliyahu's death is not very clear in the Tanakh. We're not really sure if Eliyahu really ever died. It says that he was taken up in a chariot of fire up to heaven. Maybe he burned along the way. We have no idea what happened to Eliyahu. But according to the Haggadah, all of the Haggadic texts talk about how Eliyahu is still very much alive and still very much with us. And I'd like to read some other Haggadah. I've given you a few. But if you only have time to read one, if you'd like to focus on one, I'd like you to focus on Haggadah C, which is Esther Rabbah 7:18. Okay, so if you only have time to read one, I'd like to read that one. And if you have more time, go back and read the others. If you also have time to read the story, the quick story of Elisha, that's great also, but if not, that's okay also. We'll give you about 15 minutes, okay? And then we'll wrap up. Great. everybody short. We're just going to start on the second set of sources, just to mention very briefly the story of Elisha, because I think it is important that it's another kind of textual proof to what the Midrash was trying to tell us about Eliyahu's personality. But did anyone have a chance to read the story of Elisha, or really not at all? A little bit, yes. Okay, great. So just quickly, anyone see any differences, some of the kind of glaring differences between the story of Elisha and the story of Eliyahu? Just maybe one difference that anybody saw between those two stories. How are they different? Yeah. A, she knows immediately that he's a man of God, that Elisha is a man of God. What else? Yeah, Ellen. Beautiful, okay. The miracle that Elisha wants to perform for the woman, for the Isha Gdolah, is totally for the woman. What can I do for her? And she says nothing, and he says, well, I'm going to give you something anyway. That's a different issue and a different problem, right? But his thing is that he wants to do whatever he can for her versus Eliyahu, who obviously the miracle was for, really for himself. Anything else? Any other differences? Yep.
The power imbalance is not so great. She's not so needy.
Excellent. Right. She's not so needy. She has a husband. She's an Isha Gdolah. She's a rich woman, right? This is not somebody who's going to have a hard time giving Elisha food and shelter. Obviously, this is not really a burden for her. She sees it as like an amazing blessing that she has this man of God. This is amazing for me. Obviously, we won't get too much into the stories, but I think the story just backs up what we were saying before about how B'nai Israel, there was a real need in B'nai Israel for a different type of Navi. A Navi who, when in the same situation or in a very similar situation to the situation Eliyahu was in with his Isha, when put in a similar situation, this Navi is going to react very differently. He's going to have compassion on this woman. He's going to try to do something for her instead of trying to do something for himself. And their whole relationship is very, very different from the relationship that Eliyahu has with his woman. I think that drives that point home a little bit, okay? Let's leave that for now. Pardon? So that's a great question. The story that precedes the story is about Hashem sending Elisha to another woman, and we kind of see how Elisha reacts to her. And here it seems like Elisha is just wandering. It's a different scenario, not that God is specifically sending him. But I think what's interesting is that it seems like Elisha was traveling around the land a lot. That was the kind of Navi he was. That the Tanakh specifically goes on to tell us in great detail this specific story, I think, is in order to draw the comparison between this story specifically and the Eliyahu story that we saw before, where Hashem forces Eliyahu to go. Okay, so it is a different way that they get there, but ultimately the comparison is still meant to be there. Okay, so let's just move on a little, because really that's a whole discussion in and of itself. Let's move on a little to the Agadot that happened post Eliyahu's death or disappearance. How does the Agada approach Eliyahu after he's already gone? Any differences that you can see? Any differences that you spotted in the way the Agada approaches Eliyahu? In general, what's Eliyahu's personality in these last Agadot? Much more compassionate, right? Any examples? How do we see Eliyahu's compassion in these Agadot? Pardon? He becomes an advocate for B'nai Israel, where before he was fighting against B'nai Israel, and Hashem was trying to force him to see their side a little bit, to feel some compassion. Here in these last Agadot, in these Agadot that happen after Eliyahu's death, Eliyahu is full of compassion. Not only is he full of compassion, he becomes an advocate for B'nai Israel. I specifically wanted you to read the Midrash in Esther Rabbah. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Beautiful. His personality doesn't really change. He still has that same trait, right? He still has that same zealous, we have to do what's right. I'm going to jump on this right away. This is wrong. We have to do something. But in the opposite way, right? This time he's fighting the authority figures who are not having compassion on Bnei Israel. Specifically in Esther Rabbah, Esther Rabbah points out that Bnei Israel were sinning. And that's why they were sinning. They went to Ahasuerus's party. We're all familiar with the story of the Megillah. We just read it, right? But the Midrash points out that Bnei Israel really kind of were deserving of what was coming to them. They paint Bnei Israel in this very negative light. And that's what makes it so interesting, that Bnei Israel were clearly, according to the Midrash, sinning. And yet, Eliyahu still comes and becomes their advocate, right? Even though the Midrash talks about how they weren't really deserving, here Eliyahu changes completely and sees that the people who were sinning still need someone to advocate on their behalf, but still using that same personality, right? Still using that kind of fiery, zealous type personality to yell at Moshe Rabbeinu. Why do you think that is? What is the point of the Agadah going from looking at the Tanakh and seeing Eliyahu in this much more kind of negative light to going and switching to showing Eliyahu in this kind of positive advocating for Bnei Israel perspective? What's the idea? Why does the Agadah kind of change its tune in its approach to Eliyahu? Any ideas of why that might happen? Well, what were Chazal thinking? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Beautiful. What you're saying is the whole source for all this plethora, really, there's many, many more. I just gave you four, but I think four is quite enough to get the idea, right? This whole plethora, all of these texts that we see following Eliyahu's disappearance that come up in the Midrashim over the years, really to this day, many Achronim we also see kind of talk about Eliyahu in this positive light, advocating on behalf of Bnei Israel. You're saying it's all based, there is some pshat to it. It's all based in this pasuk in Malachi. Let's read it together. We all know it off by heart. Hine anochi shaleach lachem et Eliyahu hanavi lifnei bo yom Hashem hagadol v'hanara v'heishiv lev avot al banim v'lev banim al avotam. Right? That Eliyahu is going to come and return the people to God. And you're saying that in and of itself requires a lot of compassion, and that's where the Agadah might get this kind of glimpse of Eliyahu's change after his departure. Okay? So what you're saying is anything else? Why would any other ideas of why the Agadah might change? Yeah.
Well, as a teaching tool, then mm-hmm. you can use the same characteristic for good or for bad.
Okay.
Teach people that mm-hmm. they should use their personality traits.
For positive. Uh-huh. Okay, so they're changing. They're saying that there was something negative maybe about the way Eliyahu acted during the time of Ahav, but there is something, we saw something positive in Eliyahu, and now we're going to bring it into kind of our time period and into our times. That's very beautiful. I really like that a lot. In the readings that I was doing kind of about this shift in perspective of Eliyahu, I really came upon two different approaches to this. Either that the idea is that it's a tikkun for Eliyahu, so the way that he acted beforehand, we're changing perspectives kind of to fix what he was doing, or that it's a teaching tool for Eliyahu, that every time, it doesn't really fit, I mean, I have a little bit of trouble with this one, that every time that Bnei Israel do something positive, every time there's a Brit Milah, every time we're doing something kind of to show that we are advocates for God, that we as Bnei Israel are doing something that God wanted us to do, Eliyahu should be there to witness that, to show him, Eliyahu, you didn't have any faith in the people. Look, the people are still here, and they're still advocates for God, and we're still around, and Eliyahu, you didn't believe it can happen, but it really can happen, and we want you to be there for every one of those times. I did see, maybe, right? I did see a very beautiful explanation, which I think really is, I really think is the crux of the matter, is that there's a Midrash, I think it's in Rosh Hashanah, that talks about, oh no, I'm sorry, it's in Bereishit Rabbah, and it reappears in Masechah Rosh Hashanah. In Bereishit Rabbah, it talks about how there are three types of prophets. one prophet whom we were talking about this in the back a little before. One type of prophet who's an advocate for God and an advocate for Bnei Yisrael. And that is Yirmiyahu Hanavi, and that is Moshe. We know that Moshe is a big advocate for Hashem, right? He always gets angry for Bnei Yisrael for not listening to Hashem, but he also always advocates for Bnei Yisrael. He always turns around to God and he says, save Bnei Yisrael. If you don't save Bnei Yisrael, I'm going to leave, right? I'm out of here if you don't save Bnei Yisrael. Moshe advocates on both of their behalves. There's the other type of prophet who only advocates for Bnei Yisrael. They bring the example of Yonah Hanavi, which is slightly problematic. We'll leave that over there. The type of prophet who only advocates for Bnei Yisrael, Yonah. I'm not sure I agree, but let's leave that. And the third type of prophet who only advocates on God's behalf. And that's Eliyahu Hanavi. And that is the Eliyahu Hanavi that we see in the Tanakh. And that's the Eliyahu Hanavi that our original Agadah really brought out. The type of Eliyahu Hanavi who only advocated on God's behalf. And I think that God's whole journey, the whole point of God dragging Eliyahu to all those places, was to try to get Eliyahu to use what you were saying before, to use this personality and advocate on behalf of Bnei Yisrael as well. Eliyahu, God saw something very special in Eliyahu, otherwise God wouldn't have stuck with Eliyahu for so long, right? Had God thought that Eliyahu was totally crazy and really there was nothing to him, he would have just gotten rid of him like that. Instead, God sees something very important about Eliyahu's personality, very special about Eliyahu, so he drags him through the dirt. He tries to force Eliyahu to see the other side, to see this advocate on behalf of Bnei Yisrael as well. And at the very end of Eliyahu's whole journey, which we didn't read about, his whole show at Har HaCarmel, we won't talk about it now, but at the very, very end, when God and Eliyahu face each other, Eliyahu's very upset and he's very annoyed, and God says to him, Eliyahu, what's the matter? Malachapa Eliyahu, what's your problem? And Eliyahu says, Kana kineti la Hashem. I was zealous for God. What? You know, God, I'm so upset. Bnei Yisrael are still running after me. Achaz still wants to kill me after all this time. And I did everything right. Kana kineti la Hashem. And Hashem says to him again, Eliyahu, what's the matter? And Eliyahu says again, God, kana kineti la Hashem. And God says to him finally, Eliyahu, go and get Elisha. That's it. It's over. And God saw that Eliyahu just couldn't come to terms. He just didn't get it. He couldn't come to terms with the fact that he couldn't only be a kana kineti la Hashem. He needed to also advocate on behalf of Bnei Yisrael. And I think that that's where Chazal saw this missing piece of Eliyahu. Eliyahu was so important. It was so important for Eliyahu to still kind of be around so that we can fill in that other piece of the other role of him as a prophet. Eliyahu can also use, like you said so beautifully, he can use that same personality and still be an advocate for Bnei Yisrael in the exact same way. Yeah.
The other stories only happen when he's not there.
Yes. He's no longer with us.
Until you inform he was not.
No. Exactly. And that, I think, explains why, and I mean, it's clear that Hashem really, really valued Eliyahu and valued him so much that his death is very unclear, right? It's not really clear if he ever died, if he disappeared. It's very, very unclear. Meaning, and from Malachi, even in the Navi talks about Eliyahu returning and coming back. So maybe it's a tikkun, and maybe it's a tikkun to kind of fill in that second piece that Eliyahu was missing, that God was trying so hard to get Eliyahu, to bring that out in Eliyahu during his life, that just didn't work, And in the end, now Chazal tried their best to fill in that piece by painting Eliyahu in the second picture, who is totally kana kineh la'am Yisrael. And I think that that's what makes Eliyahu so special, and that's why we see Eliyahu kind of omnipresent. He's around all the time, because we know in Tanakh, we know he was a very strong advocate for Hashem, and now we know that personality, we're familiar with that personality in Tanakh, and now when we meet him, we meet that same zealous personality, but we know that he's advocating on our behalf. And so maybe they did get that from Malachi, the Heshiv Levavot Albanim, that now Eliyahu's personality is a little bit different, is a little bit changed. It maybe it's unclear, not sure, but it's definitely true that Chazal felt it necessary to turn Eliyahu's personality in that way. And so I hope that gives us kind of a very, very general picture of Eliyahu as a whole in this whole enormous corpus of literature that's written about him. And now when you see some literature about Eliyahu, depending on the time period that it's from, you'll be able to place it depending on the personality that he had at whatever time. And hopefully we'll be able to learn more about Eliyahu in the future. I think he's a great character. Thank you very much.